Greetings to the crew of the Gaian Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is once again your navigator, John Lash, recording in the early hours of the morning, September 22nd, 2013. This is Nav Briefing number 86, The Record of the Three Attentions. It's still dark here in the mountains of Spain in Andalusia. Jupiter is high in the eastern sky. Sirius is up, and Orion. When I came upstairs about half an hour ago, the very moment that I stepped out on the stairs to come up to the upper terrace, the star Procyon crested the hill top nearby. It crested the line of trees that marks the black outline of the hilltop against the black sky. So at that very instant that I stepped out the door, the celestial anchor appeared in its entirety. And I was hit by a bit of a shiver and a shock of delight to see it again. And I was reminded yet again of what that magnificent constellation represents, namely, pleromic relay, the connection between the planetary animal mother and the planet Earth to the pleromic core, or what you could call, to pick up the old New Age meme, galactic alignment. It was just a year ago, in the month of September, that we all had the opportunity to discover that constellation together. Certainly that was one of the high points, of the many high points of the GNE so far. It's really no small matter to discover a new constellation and to be intimate with the process of how it is formed interactively between the human witness and the cosmos, the starry realms, the array of celestial code, if you want to call it that. So that was a thrill, and it remains a thrill to see it today, even though, of course, Jupiter has moved from its previous position, marking the fulcrum of the crossbar of the anchor, down into the body of the twins. And Jupiter stands right now pretty much mid-torso in the body of the twins. So I'd have you bear in mind that the twins represent, in terms of Gaian Echo sorcery, tantric magic, tantric alchemy, and transmutational sexual alchemy. So, the appearance of Jupiter exactly in the torso of the twins, let's say, if you would picture it, against the graphic visualization of the constellations, I would place it exactly at the solar plexus point where the two twins are joined. So then try to imagine, say, that the figure of the twins is not represented as it is by two male figures, Castor and Pollux, following Greek mythology. You must always bear in mind that Greek mythology is a very late derivation of centuries and millennia, in fact, of star lore that the Greeks inherited. So it's really better to call it Greek language mythology, that is to say, mythology preserved in the Greek language and in Greek legend and myth, that actually incorporates a massive amount of mythological themes and images which are not Greek at all, but they are universal images. In the nomenclature of the zodiac, in Hindu astronomy, the twins are called Maithuna, M-A-I-T-H-U-N-A. Maithuna is a pun. On the one hand, it means twins, but it is also a name for the erotic union of man and woman in Tantra. what I call sexual tantra, as opposed to tantric sex. You won't find the Nawal talking about tantric sex, because tantric sex is a worn out and discredited meme of the New Age based on some extremely naive, foolish, and misleading conceptions. So I talk about sexual tantra, and I want to give it a special nuance that you understand perfectly well. Everything is tantra. Everything in the flow of life, in the weave of life, is tantra. A conversation is tantra, and I have had some of my highest moments of tantra in conversations. My speaking to you now is tantra. When I speak from my imagination and inspiration, in my experience of reading the sky, and you are inspired, and your second attention reaches for those same visualizations, well, this is an act of tantra. We're performing a weave together. Tantra means tapestry or weave. So everything is tantra. The universe is tantra. It's a weave. But at moments, that weave goes into a sexual mode of behavior. And so you can say that that is the moment, the occasion, the opportunity of sexual tantra. But tantra happens all the time. It becomes sexual, then it fades out into the non-sexual, and then it phases back again into the sexual. Jupiter in the torso of the twins, representing, as it were, some kind of magnetic lock between their tummies, between the solar plexus centers of the two lovers in tantra, is a spectacular omen of the fall of 2013. And when you combine it with the other omen at the other side of the sky, the conjunction of Saturn with Kambalia, the first 8 days of September, well, the least I can say is that there's some powerful tantra in the air. There's some powerful erotic alchemy being generated across this planet. As you know, the constellation of the twins, where Jupiter now stands, represents that zone of the sky that carries the third and completing lesson of the 3 years of correction. The ram with the satanic head of Cetus below was the first year. The bull with the two horns representing the masculine and feminine polarities of divine imagination was the second year, and this is the third year. And as I've noted from the beginning, you can expect a fair amount of mysterious instruction coming from Idris during this time, Idris being the Mahavidya / Dakini correlated to the constellation of the twins. Idris, the mistress of fate. Idris, who leads human animals by the bridle of fate. And Idris, who oversees the union of tantric partners. I just might add, as a qualification to this dicey topic, this dicey, delicious, delightful, delectable topic, that I don't mean to be a hard ass with a superior attitude in putting down New Age tantric sex. And there could be certain things that people have learned energetically and even emotionally from exploring such programs as those of Margot Anand and Mantak Chia and other people like this. And there could be genuine alchemical secrets and practices worth pursuing to be discovered in that genre. I would just point out, however, that there are two singular difficulties with New Age tantric sex. The first being that it tends to rely upon the narcissistic paradigm of self-divinization, which is just a glorified form of narcissism. So it tends to be to wallow and bog down in glorified narcissism, even if it's, let's say, narcissism squared, you know, that is two narcissists in the lotus position, you know, doing meditations and exercises of tantric sex with each other. But the really outstanding failure and flaw in this type of teaching is that it does not incorporate the third party into the sexual act, into the tantric act. Every true act of tantric magic and tantric love is a ménage à trois, to use the French term, referring to a threesome. So two men and one woman, two women and one man is a ménage à trois. Tantra is a ménage à trois between the two tantric partners and the power of the earth and the planetary animal mother itself. She revels and celebrates the ecstasy and innocence of her tantricas. And all the acts of high tantra are performed as offerings to her. The pleasure of the tantricas is an offering to her. It is an offering to her love for the anthropos and the human animal. And so bear those outstanding factors in mind when you think about this much discussed subject of tantric sex. And there are other points I could make too, but I'm not going to dwell on that right now. I just want to say that there is another phenomenon happening in the morning sky, which I'm not quite ready to report on. The moon right now is too bright for me to make the necessary observations and to confirm them. But I will tell you that what I'm seeing is a follow-up of something that I mentioned, perhaps a little sloppily in some previous briefings. Recall that I said that I saw a tetrahedron in the sky in the area between the bull and the constellation of Auriga, the charioteer. One of the main lines defining the tetrahedron is the line from the star Capella, which is the brightest star in Auriga, to Aldebaran in the eye of the bull. And you might recall that I explained how the position of Jupiter brought my attention to that tetrahedral form. That was kind of a replay of what happened with the celestial anchor. Do you see? Remember that I detected the celestial anchor around September 7th, 2012, because the position of Jupiter against the background of the stars brought my attention to the construction of the anchor. It focused the fulcrum of the upper crossbeam. Now, Jupiter is no longer there, defining that focus, but the celestial anchor is still there, all the way from the Pleiades at the top down to Procyon, which defines the tip or point of the anchor. But now, interestingly, Jupiter having moved from that position of defining that constellation into the twins, has defined another constellation, a kind of formation, I would call it, not exactly a constellation, that I first detected a couple of months ago and that I'm now detecting even more clearly. So when I get a chance to sketch that and draw that, when the light is a little better, it would be better to present it graphically and show it graphically to you rather than to describe it verbally. I will say this, however, I do consider this omen in the dawn sky to be a sign of the breakup of the power of the Star of David, and consequently with that, the breakup of the whole Jewish Zionist agenda of master race domination and deceit that is directed against the Goyim being defined by the Jews themselves as everyone who is not Jewish. You know, part of the big lie about Judaism and Zionism is that the emphasis on anti-Semitism is a complete ruse. There may exist such a thing as anti-Semitism, defined as hatred toward Jews merely by the fact that they're Jews. Of course, I ask you to consider that there may be a good reason why people have hated Jews down through the ages, which does not have anything to do with them being Jews as such, but rather with the behavior typical of those who call themselves Jews. But putting that issue aside, anti-Semitism is used as a ruse to deflect human attention from a much more serious issue, which is the real issue, which is the anti-humanism of Judaism, particularly Talmudic Judaism, and the whole Zadokite Zionist agenda. That agenda, coming forward from Melchizedek and Abraham, is blatantly anti-human. It is against humanity. So the anti-Semitism ruse is used to disguise an anti-human attitude and an anti-human program. And the days when that ruse works are fast coming to an end. So I stand by my anticipation, not prediction, that in the last 6 or 8 months of correction, certain events will unfold in this world that will reveal the breakup and dissolution of the fixation of anti-human malevolence that is concentrated in the symbol called the Star of David or the Seal of Solomon. As that symbol, which is charged with evil intent against the Goyim, that is to say, all humanity who is not declared to be the chosen race, as that dissolves, many, many things can happen in this world which decent, kind, and well-meaning people wish to happen. So this omen is one worth following, and I am intent upon following it in the morning sky as we cruise now through fall and into winter. Before I get to the subject of the three attentions, and specifically back to The Eagle's Gift by Carlos Castaneda, I'd like to respond to some of the questions and controversy that was raised by my recent talk. That is to say, NAB Briefing 85. First of all, let me make this qualification regarding my statement that Anthropos 10 cannot be saved. Actually, that's not an accurate statement. It is certainly not at the level of accuracy that I care to achieve when I do these NAB briefings. So let me really specify what I intended to say there. When you look at any single human animal, or when you look at the collective herd of humanity, society at large, it's helpful to distinguish the animal, or person, if you will, from the behavior. So there is an animal there, and then there is the behavior of that animal. Now, two kinds of changes can occur. The animal can change its behavior, and the animal can actually change and become a different animal. The change of behavior is what many people are looking for in the world. The change of behavior is what social revolution is about. People today want to see a change of behavior, okay? People want to see, for instance, good luck. They want to see their politicians, who are dupes and puppets run by gangsters, they want to see their politicians behave differently. Well, imagine a change of behavior in those human animals who are in politics. They could change their behavior, but they would be the same animal. Now, when you talk about a change of the animal or person, that's what I mean by transmutation and transspeciation. So what I'm saying exactly is that Anthropos 10 is finished, it's game over as far as the behavior of Anthropos 10 is concerned. The social behavior of Anthropos 10 is finished and it goes nowhere. It's completely corrupted and it's nothing but a pack of lies. So living in the lies of the mainstream media, living in the lies of the Zads and the Zionists who broadcast their program of deceit across the world, living in all of the lies of modern society, the lies and the fraud and the corruption, that game is over. That game is disintegrating. It's rotten. It's falling apart. So in that sense, it's game over for Anthropos 10. Many people who would like to continue in those behaviors, characterizing the degeneration of this experiment and the degeneration of Anthropos 10, many of those who would like to continue will not be able to do so. It's unsustainable. It is impossible to continue, for instance, with three more generations of iPhones. It is impossible to continue with more sophisticated advertising in order to entrap people by mining, data mining their personal information through these social media systems and then mentally commanding them to buy things by all kinds of technological trickery. All of that can go no further than it is now. Transhumanism is dead in the water. There's no place it can go. There's no place that GMO modification can go. So all of those behaviors are finished. But what about the animals who are committing those behaviors? Well, some of the animals are going to be finished too. Some of the animals are going to go down with a behavior. And that's what I mean by the compost and the dross. But some of the animals may not. So let me make this distinction clear. I don't want to write off Anthropos 10 like I'm some kind of, you know, snob. Well, I am a snob, but, you know, only in matters of art and literature and aesthetics. When it comes to anthropology, I'm not a snob. I'm a realist. The possibility of transmutation of our species is real and happening right now. It's part of the divine alchemy. So, animals will also change. They won't just change their behavior. They will be profoundly and innately changed from the cellular level, all the way through the spectrum of physical existence. The penetration of the transmuting power of the first attention of the divine Sophia directs those changes. You got that? Now, those who are transmuting to Anthropos 11 because they have the story and because they have the methods and the techniques of planetary tantra are inwardly changing and transmuting themselves all the time. And what you are transmuting yourself into is the magical child that you were intended to be in the dreaming of the wisdom goddess. And that is a physical, cellular, biochemical transmutation. So some animals of the Anthropos 10 strain, like myself, I was born, you could say, as Anthropos 10. In 1945, I was born into Anthropos 10. I'm already halfway to being the next species, Anthropos 11. This can happen. Then there is a kind of marginal group of people. I would call them marginal. I don't know what's going to happen to them. I want to write them off. But let me give you an example of what I mean. I was talking to Kundry the other day, and we were shaking our heads and remarking about how rapidly Anthropos 10 has been captured by IT, by informational technology, by AI, by artificial intelligence, and by all the gadgets and gimmicks that are in the world today, first and foremost, of course, being cell phones. You know, I can remember when I had a dial phone. I can remember the day in Santa Fe when I got my first touchtone phone. And look at where we are now. Look at how fast this has happened. Look at footage you see of any city street in the world where people are no longer walking around, looking at each other, looking at who's coming and going around them, looking at the buildings. They're all thumbing away at their iPads or their portable phones. And it's correct and necessary to speak of a massive addiction. People are addicted to these devices, including the tablets and the others. But let's just concentrate on the iPhones for a moment. So I was talking to Kundry about this, and I said, you know, wait a minute. Let's just hold on for a second. We see this addiction. We see this high saturation of Antipost 10 totally wanting to substitute its own faculties by a narcotic simulation of those faculties. This is Google Glasses. You no longer walk around in your own faculties. You're using faculties of a prosthetic device supplied to you by the Archons. And this, people want this. So there's obviously an addiction. There's obviously a deep enmeshment. However, and this is an interesting point that came up in our conversation, however, we don't know yet. Nobody knows what would happen if those people who are caught in that addiction had to go cold turkey from it. Have you ever thought about that? Because the addiction is so massive and so far-reaching, you see it everywhere, and it's horrible. I find it horrible and disgusting. I hate those devices. There's a tendency to think, oh, they're goners, you know, but that addiction hasn't been around for that long. It's nothing compared to the addiction to tobacco, the addiction to coffee, the addiction to tea. It's been around for hundreds of years longer than the addiction to cell phones. So what would happen if, due to the crash of the grid and the breakdown of the system, that everybody, for instance, in the city of London, was deprived of those devices instantly and had to go cold turkey? Well, no one knows what would happen. But I would venture to guess that some human animals who are deprived of that behavior would no longer be able to function at all and would break down and go insane. But some human animals wouldn't. Some human animals would snap out of it like that. They would snap out of it because the addiction, although it appears immense and all-consuming, is actually very recent and may in fact be trivial. Now, you know, what is driving that addiction is simply money. It's simply the money in the telecommunications business. The money and the profit to be made by setting up shortwave towers and by doing all this technology. But all of that is already hitting the wall. And when it comes down, some human animals may stand free. So I'm not going to write off Anthropos 10 on that account. I'm going to leave the portal open. Okay, so to proceed now with a couple of responses that came in to the recent talk 85, Castaneda to Calica. Here is one response from Stephanie in Santa Fe. My question to you regarding NB85 is really about a follow-up question to crew member Suzanne's question that you referenced. I already knew the answer to her question even before you answered it. I get that it's game over for A10 and that the Calica War Party serves the purpose of eliminating the threats to A11. Let's clear out the mold in the Petri dish, shall we? It's crystal clear. And the sooner the better. My question, though, is what is she planning to do about the other creatures in this experiment who are also her creations? The animals. I want to know about the animals. Will they survive? My second attention tells me there will be even more diversity of species who will thrive with the coming A11. So it is a waste of my time to continue fighting the predators, psychopaths, to protect the ones who are here now, meaning the animals. Case being, just today, after hearing your NB, I read that the fucking Koch brothers are now financing and promoting the political war on wolves, going into various Western states. They want to completely extinguish this sacred animal. Believe it or not, even though I'm a mother, I have even more anger, more hatred, and fight in me to protect the wolf than I do other A10 children. So that's Stephanie there. She's obviously fighting mad and taking a warrior's stand in Sophia's correction. As for her question, it's a fantastic one. Would require a lot more investigation, something we haven't discussed until now, something I haven't even brought up. But I can tell you, in a general and overall sense, something that may be reassuring. The role that other animals in the habitat of the planet play in Sophia's dreaming is not like the role that the Anthropos plays. Well, you already know that. Only the Anthropos can have access to the syntax of her dreaming in such a way as to be co-creative and participatory with that access. So the other animal species, everything you can think of, from birds to whales to coyotes to wolves, are expressions of the animal powers of the Great Mother. And they operate in her dreaming, if I might use a crude term, a crude expression, they operate in her dreaming in a different way than the Anthropos does. So to a certain extent, I can't answer the question because I haven't investigated what the Aeon Sophia would intend to do with these animals. But I concur with Stephanie that my second attention also tells me that there will be even more diversity of species that will be drawn forth out of Sophia's dreaming as the Anthropos achieves and attains and manifests its magical powers. And I also sense very strongly that some human animals in the remaining 200 years of this kalpa will have the opportunity to witness directly the manner in which the Aeon Sophia can resurrect and regenerate any animal species she likes from its state of extinction. So although she may put animals into extinction, you know, for her to put animals into extinction, it doesn't look in her mind like it looks to us, you see. In her mind, it's simply changing the palette that she's working from in dreaming the colors and forms of the natural world. She'll change her palette, that's all. But she can the phenomenon of the Cambrian explosion, which everyone in the GNE ought to study. And you can read an interesting chapter about it, by the way, in Jeremy Narby's important book, The Cosmic Serpent. Talks about the Cambrian explosion in there. The Cambrian explosion demonstrates the ability of the Aeon Sophia to resurrect spontaneously. It's called spontaneous generation. Any species out of extinction. So those are two different subjects. What is happening to the Anthropos in transspeciation and what is happening to the entire range of insects, snakes, birds, fish, and animals in the Gaian habitat, and how are those two related? And that's a tremendous topic, and that's about all I can tell you about it at this point. Now I'd like to turn to another mail, or two mails, that I got from someone on the crew named Aristo. And I'll answer the second mail first. The second mail is just a short mail that says, well, if the gods are not omnipresent and all-knowing of all future events, how could the Gnostics foresee the outcome of the end of Anthropos 10 and the continuation of Anthropos 11? Well, excuse me, but the Gnostics are not the gods. So it's certain that the Pleuromic Aeons cannot see the outcome of any experiment. They do not control the outcome, so they are not omniscient in that sense. So it was not the Pleuromic Aeons who saw the necessity of a correction in this experiment with Anthropos 10. It was the Gnostic seers themselves investigating the cosmic background and the cosmic biography of the wisdom goddess who detected the notion of correction, who detected the opportunity and necessity of correction. And in fact, what we have been doing, you and I, in the GNE from the get-go, is to reiterate the act of the Gnostic seers and to carry forward the witnessing of Sophia's correction, to carry it forward, because at the moment that they saw it, some millennia ago, they weren't in it. Now we are witnessing it and involved in it at the same time. And that's completely derived from the faculties of the Anthropos and from the intelligence and use of the first and second attention with which are endowed, okay? Now, to return to a longer question, and this is a really dicey one, I like this. Get this. From the same individual called the GNA stowaway. I love that. So there's a stowaway on board, and this is what the stowaway is observing. Upon hearing MB-85, I have to say that the questions asked by the other GNE crew members were thoughts and questions I also had. Now that you have made your position clear, other observations and questions arise. With you being a comparative mythologist, am I wrong to correlate the similarities of the current course of GNE and the Kalaika War Party with the Book of Revelations? Not all the details of trumpets and horses, but the fact that the majority of mankind is abolished and the chosen few are spared. I haven't read the Torah nor the Koran, but I believe that the Jews also claim to be the chosen people and welcome Armageddon, as they are the ones to be spared from the wrath of God. I can't help but find the same theme now being played out in the GNE. Is the correlation the fact that these religions all took from the current writings at the time from the Gnostics, and that they contain that truth of Gnosticism, but in a distorted form? And if I may play the devil's advocate, is not the NWO gang, New World Order, also playing into this theme? Don't worry about anything. The destruction of man is in God's hands. All the while, they will coordinate and manipulate the outcome in their favor. Your input will be greatly appreciated. I love this question because, first of all, it's so respectful and clean. You know, it could easily have taken me to task and accused me of peddling this a Gaian version of the Book of Revelation and of the master race chosen people theme, substituting the Kalaika War Party and the GNE for the Jews. You know, I could easily be busted by someone on those claims, but this is a completely honest, open, and transparent inquiry. So now, to respond as briefly and cogently as I can, because I want to bring this briefing around again to the subject of Castaneda and the three attentions. Well, look, it's like this. No, I would not say that the Armageddon / Book of Revelation scenario is a distorted truth that reflects the deeper truth that Gnostics understood about the end of the Kalpa and the end of the world scenario. I would not say that, although in many ways that could be argued as the case. Rather, I would say that the Armageddon Book of Revelation scenario is evidence of a psychotic breakdown of the human mind that occurred around 2,000 years ago. And this psychotic breakdown, this insanity, this episode of insanity that is recorded in the Book of Revelation, and that reflects the previous insanity of the Jews, the archontically inspired insanity of master race theory and the Messiah concept and the judgment of the world at the end of days and the Armageddon scenario. All of that from the Jewish psychosis was incorporated into the Christian psychosis of St. John the Divine, who is attributed to writing the Book of Revelation. And so it's a one psychosis mutated into a further psychosis. And what do I mean by psychosis? I mean a mental breakdown that occurred in the human mind due to the inability of the human mind to accept the power of nature to decide the fate of humanity. At the end of the day, it is this planet and the living presence of the Aeon Sophia in this planet that decides the fate of this experiment. Now, the Gnostics knew that deeply, and they accepted that, and they, in fact, embraced the power of the goddess to do as she wishes with her own experiment, now that she is captured in it, to do what she is able to do. And so it wasn't as if St. John the Divine had the same perception that the Gnostics had, although I do think that he had some Gnostic input, and I've discussed that in the talks that I made on the Book of Revelation. But rather, it's that St. John the Divine just represents the religious consciousness of humanity 2,000 years ago that broke down in its own paradigm. It broke down and went insane in its own paradigm, because within that paradigm, it is impossible to accept the real expression and the real revelation of the animal powers of the earth and how they operate. So even though the animal powers of the earth, which are of the number of 18 and 666, which adds up to 18, and which consists of 7 components and 10 components and 1 component in the same structure of the Shakti cluster, even though that manifestation or epiphany of the animal powers comes up in the psychotic mental breakdown of John the Divine, the key point is that he's not able to accept it. It's not about having an esoteric truth or not having it, or distorting an esoteric truth. It's about accepting the power of the earth and its superior beauty and wisdom regarding the fate of the human animal and the fate of this experiment. And Christians and Jews and Muslims and people who adhere fanatically to this Armageddon scenario, including the New World psychopaths who play it as a geopolitical game, don't have any esoteric or Gnostic knowledge of any kind. They're ignorant of all that. But the more important factor is that they cannot accept the obvious. They cannot accept the obvious superiority of the power of the earth over any human plans or designs. And likewise, and equally so, or even more so, they cannot see and accept the part that human animals would have in the plans and designs of the wisdom goddess. So, lacking both of those factors, when they are confronted with the obvious possibility that nature will do things that human beings can't control, and possibly even bring the human species into some kind of extinction, selective or not, confronted with the reality of that, they just go nuts, and they invent these scenarios in a desperate attempt to use their imagination to control what they cannot control. So it's all about control, you see? And so I would say that the difference, if I were confronted in a more hostile manner, as I might well be, and I think I was once confronted with this issue, oh, John, you're just peddling Gayan Tantra, you're just peddling another version of the chosen people, you know, those who elect to be in planetary Tantra are the chosen people, and they're going to survive in the next phase of this experiment, and the other people are going to go down into some Armageddon scenario. If I were to be confronted with that, you know, in a more hostile manner, I would simply say there's no argument here. It's not about... I am very conscious as a comparative mythologists of the themes and myth-themes that I use when I teach. I am extremely conscious and extremely cautious about how I use these powerful myth-themes or mythological motifs. And I assure you that I am not using the GNE or planetary tantra or the concept of trans-speciation by application of the same paradigm that you find in the chosen people scenario. No, it is completely different. But the crux of that difference is based on the concept of control. the implication of the biblical scenario and the end of the world scenario in Judaism and in the book of Revelation is that those who are in the favor of the Supreme Father God and his Messiah will escape ultimate destruction and be delivered into another world. But the deeper implication, look at the deeper implication of that scenario. That means that they can control what's happening. They can control their fate inside a script whose end is predetermined. That is not the paradigm of the GNE or planetary tantra or the end of this kalpa in the next 200 years of Kali Yuga. That is not the paradigm. We are not in control of the outcome. We are in participation with the outcome. It is a different dynamic entirely. And that participation has so many magnificent and beautiful aspects that lead to the flowering of the true endowment of the human animal that there is no way in my mind that you can possibly compare it with the niggling, shitty idea of a predetermined chosen people who get their asses saved on the day of Armageddon. There's no contest here. There's no comparison. So although there may be some superficial resemblances or parallels, when you look into it, there is no correspondence of the kind that is suggested here by this kind and sincere inquiry. So I would summarize the difference by saying that in the Judaic Armageddon scenario, you find the illusion of control. Those who believe that the Father God is omniscient and omnipotent and has a plan with a beginning, middle, and an end that cannot be changed, and who maintain that by their belief in that plan, a fixed plan, beyond human control, and their adherence to the rules of God, the commandments, their obedience, that they can control their own fate, are in the illusion of control. So what is contained within that scenario is the illusion of control that ultimately traces back to the lie of the Archons who seeded that scenario in the minds of the ancient Hebrews. By contrast, with GNE and Planetary Tantra, there is no illusion of control. There is the reality of participation. You don't obey any rules. You engage in the experiment knowing that there is not, that its end is not definitively written, even by the Aeon Sophia herself, even by the Pleromic gods. And in that engagement, you enter a process of magic, discovery, experimentation, and an enhancement of the human spirit to its highest potential as anthropos. And that development within the GNE and PT stands boldly against the behavior of the chosen people and the way that they act in the world among themselves and toward those whom they consider to be excluded from their agenda. So I don't think I can put it any more clearly than that. I'm really grateful for this question. Now let me see if I can get back to Carlos. I have here a copy of The Eagle's Gift, and I've marked a number of passages. Let me look them over here for a second. Okay, the first passage comes on page 18. Quote, in order to explain these concepts of dreaming and not doing and so forth, Don Juan made a three-part uneven division of our consciousness. He called the smallest the first attention and said that it is the consciousness that every normal person has developed in order to deal with the daily world. It encompasses the awareness of the physical body. Another larger portion he called the second attention, and described it as the awareness we need in order to perceive our luminous cocoon and to act as luminous beings. He said that the second attention remains in the background for the duration of our lives, unless it is brought forth through deliberate training or by an accidental trauma, and that it encompasses the awareness of the luminous body. He called the last portion, which is the largest, the third attention, an immeasurable consciousness which engages undefinable aspects of the awareness of the physical and the luminous bodies, end quote. So there you have what might be considered a summary statement, a concise statement regarding the three attentions. It could be the only paragraph anywhere in Castaneda's writings where he describes the three attentions together in one paragraph. As you know, if you've read Castaneda, the various shamanic techniques and key terms such as dreaming, not doing, control, folly, first attention, and dozens of others are scattered throughout the writing, and there is not ever a continuous and systematic exposition of these practices and themes. There are passages in which Castaneda concentrates, say, on the topic of not doing, or the topic of dreaming together, or the Nahual woman, or the parallel lines. But there is not really a systematic teaching. It's the teaching of the Neo-Toltec sorcery comes through the story form, in the form of tales of power, in the form of anecdotes. And through all this anecdotal material, which Castaneda presents in a playful manner as the field notes of an anthropologist, gradually, over and over again, these themes are repeated. Does it remind you of something? Sure, well, that's exactly how the GNE unfolds, isn't it? If you were to sit down and try to make a list of the directive terms or the key syntax of the GNE, you would probably come up with a list of 50 words, wouldn't you? And then you would find that throughout the briefing so far and the written crew notes, those various themes and practices are brought up time and time again and interwoven with other ideas, and then they drop away and then they come up again. Well, this is a similarity. This indicates this style of exposition, if you will, indicates remarkable similarity between the legacy of Carlos Castaneda and the planetary tantra now unfolding in the Gaian navigation experiment. Why are these two bodies of teaching similar? Because they are both innovative forms of creative imagination. The GNE is the first great experiment at the beginning of the 21st century of the parameters of creative imagination proposed by Joseph Campbell in the last two decades of the 20th century. I am certain that people in the future will study the GNE, and they will study it for years to come. If there is anyone in the near or distant future, and by distant future I mean 30 to 50 to 80 years from now, who can actually recognize what is operating and unfolding in the GNE, well, they would be compelled to study it closely, just as some people today are still compelled to go back and study the legacy of Neo-Toltec sorcery in the works of Carlos Castaneda. But the difference is that The GNE and Planetary Tantra are based in Gnosticism and in its correlation or conversion into Tantra. And so the GNE has a foundation. So does Castaneda, of course, but the foundation of Castaneda is really hidden. Nobody knows what the Toltecs really did. Nobody knows very much about it. There's a fair amount of reconstruction, or I would call it retrofitting, of the Toltec way of life and Toltec practices. There's a great amount of that. You know, this thing about the four agreements and various other parallel teachings or spin-offs of Castaneda purport to bring forth a Toltec teaching, but there is no actual body of Toltec teaching as such to found it upon. Bear in mind that the mystical and shamanic practices of the Toltecs, the Aztecs, and the Maya were held in deep secrecy and were encoded. And although some of those teachings and practices were indicated in the sacred writings of those Mexican peoples, most of them were not. And as I've said before, in order to go into Toltec, Maya, Aztec magic, you have to be able to access particular banks or repositories in the organic light, which I call conicles, C-O-N-A-C-L-E-S. And these conicles are actually holographic archives in which, for instance, the lore and magic of the jaguar and shaman cults of the Maya are preserved. So, recovering and restoring the Toltec magic requires an act of shamanic retrieval. That itself is a fascinating topic. Who today is undertaking this act of retrieval? If you're out there, let me know. Another thing that I'd like to point out that is different with PT, Planetary Tantra, compared to Castaneda, is that not only is Planetary Tantra current, and you are involved in it as it is developing, rather than catching up with it as you read the books, it is also utterly transparent. Everything in Planetary Tantra and in Kala Tantra is utterly transparent and open to the world at large. Now, I don't know. This is a question I would ask regarding the record of the Three Attentions and regarding the legacy of Castaneda as a whole. This is my question. Who is carrying it forward today? Where is the movement? Where is the continuation of the Sorcerer's Party, formed first by Don Juan, his own Sorcerer's Party, consisting of male and female warriors, stalkers and dreamers, and so forth, and then Castaneda's warrior party, modeled on Don Juan's warrior party? Where is the generation, the current generation of those warrior parties? Are they out there? Are they doing something in the world? Are they actively and coherently pursuing Castaneda techniques of sorcery? And if so, are they doing it out in the open? Or are they doing it all by themselves somewhere in some mountains in Colorado or wherever they may be in Mexico? Well, I don't know. I haven't been contacted by any of these people. I haven't been contacted by anything that's convincing to me that such a follow-up movement exists. So I lead you to the same conclusion that I lead myself to, which is, why not consider Planetary Tantra to be the follow-up movement? If you go back and go over all the Castaneda books and make a note of the volume and the page in which he says something about the first attention, the second attention, and the third attention, then you would have a compilation, which I call the Record of the Three Attentions. Now, this one paragraph that I just read is not a complete record of the three attentions. It's just a mention of all three in one paragraph. Now, I could propose this exercise for some members of the crew. 10 of you could each take a particular book. I don't think there's any mention of the first or second attention in the early books. I can't remember what is the first mention, but it would not be difficult to reread the books and to catalog every single passage in which Castaneda says something about the first attention, the second, and the third. That would be a record of the three attentions. It would be worth making that record. However, so what? What would happen after you made that record? Castaneda's books appeared over a period of 31 years. As I said before, those of us who followed the books were always in anticipation of the next book, but then when we read it, we were in exasperation because we were reading about acts of power and techniques of magic and shamanic ordeals that had already taken place, so you could never be current with the Castaneda process, as it were. You could never be current with the Neo-Toltec sorcery as it was happening. Well, by contrast, you can only be current with Planetary Tantra. There is no other way to be involved in it, except as it is unfolding right now in real time. And so the record of the three attentions drawn from all references in the works of Castaneda would be an artifact of sorts, wouldn't it? It would be a valuable record and a valuable reference tool, perhaps. But I venture to add that whatever he said about the three attentions is only a preparation from what you are learning now about the three attentions. And some of the things that he said about them may not be relevant to the three attentions in the current experiment, in the current practice of Gaian echo sorcery. Now, when I began the Gaian navigation experiment, one of the first things that I introduced was the Castaneda terms, first attention and second attention. And I made the simple correlations which are to be followed consistently in the GNE. The first attention is connected to the power of divine alchemy of the wisdom goddess. You as a human animal, the magical child of her dreaming, have your first attention, and she has her first attention, and that correlates to the factor of observation of the physical world. The second attention is defined by the syntax divine memory, memory and imagination being the same function, or memory being a subset of the function of imagination. It's the record button on the instrument of imagination. The Aeon Sophia has her divine memory, her second attention, and the human animal has its second attention. Now, as we come into the third year of the GNE, with the emphasis on the constellation of the twins and doubling, which is, of course, a huge theme all through Castaneda's work, it so happens that the Nawal introduces the subject of the third attention. And, of course, what I've said already about the third attention, you may have noticed, goes way beyond anything Castaneda said in terms of its user-friendly aspects, in terms of its availability and accessibility. As I recall, having read the whole series of books a number of times, he made very few allusions to the third attention. He does say, though, already in The Eagle's Gift, which is the sixth book, that at the end of their practice to attain complete freedom by slipping past the eagle, the sorcerer's party enters into the third attention and disappears. So Castaneda made some claims about the third attention. What you are now learning are things about the third attention and how to use it that he never claimed or never said. There is no contradiction or competition between Castaneda's sorcery and Gayaneco's sorcery. They are highly complementary, but the fact is that one is current and one is passé. Now, if Castaneda's Neo-Toltec sorcery is not passé, and someone hears me say so, someone who comes across this briefing, then write me an email and correct me on that point. But I can already tell you what my response would be. If you are someone out there who considers yourself to be in the continuation of Castaneda's lineage, who is practicing real Neo-Toltec sorcery and applying and testing and proving and demonstrating the techniques spread out through his books, then what are you doing with it? So what? What is the application of it? What are you applying it to? And for what purposes? And are you open and accessible in doing so? Or are you engaged in some kind of behind-the-scenes cultic activity? And if so, what is the point or purpose of that? So those are questions that are floating in the air and floating in my mind as I'm rereading Castaneda. Now, I'd like to bring this briefing to a close by mentioning, again, the decisive chapter in The Eagle's Gift, which in many respects may be considered as the turning point in the whole series of 11 books, and that would be Chapter 9, The Rule of the Nahual. Now, is there an equivalent in Planetary Tantra to the Rule of the Nahual, something that assumes a central and directive role in the trajectory of the whole shamanic adventure? Yes, indeed there is, and that is called the Bridge, or the Rule of the Kalikas. And that term would be then the title and topic of my next briefing, number 87, The Rule of the Kalikas. So in concluding this briefing, I'd just like to point out two most significant parallels and correlations between what was happening in Castaneda's adventures and what is now unfolding in Planetary Tantra and the GNE. As far as I know, Castaneda had introduced women into the Sorcerer's Party in the fifth book, The Second Ring of Power, which is the transitional book in the whole series, as you know. And then in the sixth book, The Eagle's Gifts, he begins to talk about the phenomenon of dreaming together. In fact, chapter 7 is called Dreaming Together. Well, does that ring any bells? You might recall the ritual that Kundry and I performed in our last Telestic session at the request of the Colombian allies. By Colombian allies, of course, I mean those genial species inhabiting the mushroom plants that were ritually ingested for that telestic session. So when you ingest psychoactive mushrooms or any kind of psychoactive plants such as Salvia divinorum or Datura, Inoxia, you actually allow another species to operate in your brain and nervous system, as it were, to drive your car. And it has been known in folklore all through the ages, folklore all around the world, that these plant species speak to human animals in the syntax of their own language, and they can speak any language you like. Why? Because they are in the brain circuits and in the synaptic circuits where language is held. So as long as the chemistry of the plant enters those circuits, the species or intelligence indwelling that plant speaks to you. And speaking to the various Colombians, the Mexicana, the Cubensis entities, there are many varieties of psychoactive mushrooms, is an enormous privilege and pleasure of telestic shamanism. Well, it appears that the Colombians cut us quite a deal, and I am more and more convinced that the double thread that we drew for them from the living mycelium of the organic light represents the act of dreaming together, and they carried that thread down into the underworld in order precisely to enhance that practice from this moment on, up until the return of Venus in spring of 2014. They are developing within the infernal powers of the earth a new octave of the magical practice of dreaming together. And so we in the GNE, you and I, and everyone who comes into this experiment in the near or distant future has the opportunity to carry forward the practice of dreaming together that Castaneda introduced in the Eagle's Gift. This is indeed a glorious, marvelous, and stunning prospect, and I am thrilled to my bones to even be able to describe this to you, and I am also thrilled in my cells to have been able to glimpse some of the initial practices of dreaming together during these fantastic weeks of September 2013. So finally, in transition to the next briefing on the rule of the Kalikas, which is called the bridge, let me refer to the primary archetypal image of the Eagle's Gift, and that is to say, the eagle itself. So in the chapter on the rule of the Nahual, this is what Castaneda wrote. First, he refers to the experience of Don Juan with his teacher, who I believe would have been the Nahual Julian. And Castaneda wrote, "The old Indian," meaning the Nahual Julian, "was kind but severe. One day when Don Juan was fairly strong, almost recovered, the old man gave him a sound blow on his back and forced him into a state of heightened awareness. Then, without any further preliminaries, he revealed to Don Juan the portion of the rule which pertained to the Nahual and his role. Don Juan did exactly the same thing with me and with La Gorda. He made us shift levels of awareness and told us the rule of the Nahual in the following way. The power that governs the destiny of all living beings is called the eagle, not because it is an eagle or has anything to do with an eagle, but because it appears to the seer as an immeasurable jet-black eagle standing erect as an eagle stands, its height reaching to infinity." End quote. So in that passage, Castaneda introduces the image of the eagle and the rule of the Nahual related to that magnificent and compelling archetypal image. So in concluding this briefing, I'm going to read you a passage from a Gnostic text from Nag Hammadi. This is called the Apocryphon of John, or the Secret Book of John. Now, if you have the Nag Hammadi library in English, which is that translation by James Robinson, you will find this in passage following passage number 23. The texts are arranged according to passages, which are indicated by numbers in bold. It's on page 118 of the hardcover edition, and here it comes. I'm reading two paragraphs from this text. The first one presents a magnificent evocation of Adam and Eve as a pair of tantrikas, or tantric lovers, if you will. "And he," Adam, "saw the woman beside him, And in that moment the luminous Epinoia appeared, and she lifted the veil which lay over his mind. And he became sober from the drunkenness of darkness, and he recognized his counter-image, and he said, "This is indeed bone of my bone, and flesh of my flesh. Therefore the man will leave his father and his mother, and will cleave to his wife, and they will both be one flesh. For they will send him his consort, and he will leave his father and mother." And our sister Sophia is she who came down in innocence in order to rectify her deficiency. Therefore she was called Life, which is the mother of the living, by the foreknowledge, pronoia, of the sovereignty of heaven. And through her they have tasted the perfect knowledge of Gnosis. It appeared in the form of an eagle on the tree of knowledge, which is the epinoia from the foreknowledge of the pure light, that I might teach them and awaken them out of the depth of sleep. For they were both in a fallen state, and they recognized their nakedness. The epinoia appeared to them as a light, and she awakened their thinking.